happy March 1st, 2016. I hope those of you in the United States all went out and voted today. And man, what a hilarious comedy of errors this election year is. I don't usually make political statements, but God, what a tragedy. What a tragedy this election year has been. The Republicans all stand up like mean girls yelling at each other about how their mothers dressed them funny and how their hair is ugly and their hands look funny and their nails are badly done and how goofy they are. It's just a terrible, terrible thing, and I'll be glad when it's over. And my predictions, for the record, are as follows. Hillary Clinton will be our president. Donald Trump will slink back into his obscurity, and his followers will slink back to their trailer parks, their KKK and NRA meetings, and the rest of the country will just try to forget this election year ever happened. But I am John St. Germain, and our program tonight is, of course, we're going on about the Eightfold Noble Path of the Buddha. And tonight we're going to talk a little bit about the spread of Buddhism throughout the Middle East and how it influenced Christianity. We're going to talk a little bit about Buddhism and Christianity as we talk about the Eightfold Noble Path. And this was brought to my attention by some conversations with friends of mine recently about, they were saying, well, you know, do you have to choose between Buddhism and Christianity? Can you be a Christian and a Buddhist? And the answer to that, of course, is yes. You can be a lot of things. So let's come back in just a few minutes. We're going to have our crystal of the week. We're going to have our prayers of the week. And we're going to delve into this fascinating topic in just a few moments. So enjoy a little bit of calming and spiritual music. And we'll be right back. John St. Germain, March 1st, 2016. Well, my goodness, it's this year is going by very fast. And our crystal of the week is a golden rutile, sometimes called rutilated quartz, golden rutilated quartz. And it's a wonderful stone. It's a master crystal that promotes spiritual and emotional healing. And if you wear it as an amulet or you carry it as a charm, it can balance and energize the entire aura, and it can tease out hidden reserves of energy and knowledge. Like most quartz, it's a grounding stone and a healing stone, and it's called the Master Healer. So it is a wonderful stone to have in your arsenal of stones. For those of you who don't know, the Crystal Silence League is an organization that was originally founded in 1917 or so by Claude Alexander Conlin for the purpose of promoting and distributing positive affirmation for all those in need. And this is done through the agency of crystal balls. You have a master sender, such as Mr. Conlin, who sent out via a master crystal positive affirmation and prayer, which sometimes are called gift waves. And these are received, these tonics, as he called them, are received via crystal balls by his many students and followers. When he passed into the silence around 1954, I believe, the Crystal Silence League went with him. It was revived, though, in 2009 by adepts of the Missionary Independent Spiritual Church online in cybernetic form. A new type of network was formed. And if you log on to www.crystalsilenceleague.org, you can find us. And you can post prayers online. And prayer is always free at Crystal Silence League. And we get hundreds, and I'm not exaggerating, hundreds of prayers per week posted there. And our pastors print these prayers out, and we pray for them on our altar via the agency of Crystal Balls. And it's been my custom since we started this show over a year and a half ago to print some of these prayers out and read them aloud on air, and I invite you to join me in prayer for these individuals. I do not read names aloud. These are anonymous, as they are on our website. I only read them aloud by prayer ID number. However, according to our beliefs, the prayer nonetheless is effective and directed to the individuals who post the prayer. So please join me in praying for the following individuals. Prayer ID number 48248, who prays that her son, who has himself a baby girl, but hasn't seen her, gets straight with that and also finds himself with his life together. This is it's kind of a rambling sort of thing. Gets his life together and gets a good woman and gets together with his baby girl. Prayer ID number 48247 prays that her man, whose initial begins with N, please stays with her as her man for always. Prayer ID number 48246, she has mild depression, and prays that she and her friend C be lifted up, and all negatively affected people stay away from those who affect them negatively. Prayer ID number 48245, these prayers for peace, and prays that she and W will be married within months. Prayer ID number 48244 prays that all black magic is cleared away from his or her life as soon as possible. Prayer ID number 48243 prays for justice in court, that she wins her trial. Prayer ID number 48242 prays for healing in a relationship. Prayer ID number 48241 is a singer who's lost her voice and prays that she gets her voice back. Prayer ID number 48240 is releasing some audio files, apparently musical, and prays that they are well received and creates income. Prayer ID number 48239 prayers for that all curses and bad magic on her are eliminated. Prayer ID number 48238 has been diagnosed with cancer, and her personal strength and income has dropped considerably, but she's healing, and she prays that she gets better and that her daughter, who has put aside college to care for her, is blessed, and that they need a quiet, affordable home, and they need for their income to rise. You know, may they be blessed and may they be healed. Prayer ID number 48236. They need healing within a relationship of someone they know. They pray that M give D another chance to be together. Prayer ID number 48235. Her mother's blood pressure is out of control, and she's praying for healing for her mother. Prayer ID number 48234 wants to thank everyone at the Crystal Silence League who prayed for her to get enough money to pay her tickets so she can get her license back. Apparently, the prayers came through. Prayer ID number 48233 needs prayer to move things forward with her learning, support, and studies. There are people who are deliberately stopping her progress, praying for removal of those obstacles. Prayer ID number 48232 needs money to help pay for a steady room and a safe room, a place to stay. Prayer ID number 48231 needs a steady living situation also. And our final prayer is prayer number 48229. Needs to have all obstacles and all paths clear for love to enter her life. May all these prayers be answered. May these people who have asked for help receive help, and may they receive comfort and solace. And let's take just a moment of silence to pray for everyone who needs help and who needs comfort and who needs deliverance from suffering. Amen. And we're back. Our topic tonight is the Noble Eightfold Path, and we're going to look at a little bit of how Buddhism may have influenced Christianity and the commonalities between Buddhism and Christianity. What we know is that how East met West in the trade routes between the Eastern and Western trade routes go back to great antiquity. We know that cuneiform tablets as early as 2400 BC describe shipments of cotton, spice, oil grains, and peacocks from the Indus Valley to the Middle East. And we know that the silk and spice routes carried more than trade goods. There are papyrus fragments from Egypt that contain passages in southern Indian languages. So we know that Egypt and India exchanged philosophical ideas. And long before the word missionary came to be synonymous with Christianity, Buddhist monks, who were known as Dharma Banakas, were traveling all over Asia. From the Buddhist heartland on the Ganges, notions of various ideas accompanied the spice and the incense all over the continent. Traveling the trade routes, they spread their doctrines all the way from Koh Tan in Central Asia to Antioch and Alexandria in the West. One such visit is documented in a 20 BC in Athens, and we saw how Buddhist thought was well established in Hellenistic Greece in the writings of Philo a couple of weeks ago. A Buddhist philosopher, Zarmaris, part of an embassy from India, made a doctrinal point by setting himself on fire, and his tomb became a tourist attraction and is mentioned by several historians. So clearly the evangelists of Buddha were committed to their cause of spreading the doctrines everywhere. So is it just possible that many of the teachings of Jesus were influenced by the teachings of Buddha? Well, let's look a little closer. Alexander, who lived between 336 to 323 BC, carried Greek civilization to the east, and cities along the trade route became Greek military colonies, and the Indian province in the northwest, Gandhara, had been a Persian satrap before the arrival of the Greeks, and in the 2nd century BC, Greek kingdoms with a distinctive Greco-Bactrian culture emerged, but the flow of culture was two ways. The Greeks adopted the Indian war elephant and a great deal of speculative Indian thinking. Greek philosophers like Anaxarchus and Pyrrho had been in the train of Alexander and had mixed with the Indian gymnosophists, or naked philosophers. Even the more ancient Pythagoras, the Pythagorean theory, was most probably influenced by Indian ideas. The Pythagoreans adopted vegetarianism, communal property, and the idea of the transmigration of souls. So after the conquest of the Indian Valley, the Greeks never again returned to the pantheon of their Olympian gods. And at that time, the first school of skepticism arose, analytical investigation of ideas. So at the time of Alexander, the Magadha Empire had dominated the middle and upper Ganges, but Alexander didn't get that far. But when Alexander was stopped at the Alps, there was a vacuum, and to bring the East and the West close together, an emperor by the name of Chandragupta founded this empire, the Mauryan Empire. Now, Chandragupta is very interesting because he conquered a lot of territory, including the province of Kosala, where a Hindu grassroots reformer known as Gautama Siddhartha, also known as Shakyamuni Buddha, began advocating the middle path between greed and asceticism. So Siddhartha's philosophizing had very little consequence outside his immediate area during his own lifetime. But about 300 years before Christ, the grandson of Chandragupta, Emperor Ashoka, who you might recall from a couple of weeks ago, ascended the Mauryan throne and sent missionaries everywhere. Like Marcus Aurelius, he spent his later life in soul-searching, pondering the afterlife, and in an action like Emperor Constantine, he had the usual fiery zeal of a new convert and sent these missionaries everywhere. So what we see is Chandragupta, who ruled during the Buddha's lifetime, his grandson became Emperor Ashoka and sent the missionaries everywhere. So the Ashokan edicts, which we saw were inscribed on rocks and stone pillars everywhere, described conquest by Dharma. And carved in stone is Ashoka's urging of forgiveness. The killing, death, or deportation of a hundredth or even a thousandth part of those who died during the conquest of Kalinga now pains Ashoka. Now Ashoka thinks that even those who do wrong should be forgiven where forgiveness is possible. A very strange departure from what went before. So by this time, the Buddha's words had been codified into a number of suttas or sutras, propagated by a growing number of rival sects. There were a lot of different sects at this point. Sarvastivadins, Theravadins, Hinayanas, Mahayanas, quite a few. So by the 3rd century BC, the Empire of Ashoka included a vast area of the Greeks' Eastern Empire, established a century earlier, and beyond. There are records from Alexandria that indicate the arrival of a steady stream of the Buddhist monks and philosophers in Alexandria, and it seems the original Theraputae were sent by Ashoka on an embassy to Pharaoh Ptolemy II in 250 BC. And, of course, the Theraputae we talked about when we read from Philo Judaeus, the first century contemporary of Josephus. It appears they were a religious brotherhood without precedent in the Jewish world. They were reclusive ascetics, devoted to poverty, celibacy, good deeds, and compassion. They were the Buddhist monks, in fact, that settled in Judea and Greece. From the Theraputae, a Buddhist influence spread to both the Essenes, who are a similar monkish order in Palestine, and to the Gnostics, who are adepts of philosophical speculations. So we see influence of Buddhism on Gnosticism, and Buddhism was a religion of quite a different order to earlier pagan, quote-unquote, cults. It was a scriptural religion, making a strong appeal to the emotions, and it offered a moral code and a hope of release from the samsaric cycle of suffering. Now, we look at Cyril of Jerusalem, who wrote a series of catechetical lectures, and this is very interesting. He talks about Terebinthus. He says, "But Terebinthus, his disciple in this wicked world, inherited his money and books and heresy, and came to Palestine, and becoming known and condemned in Judea, He resolved to pass into Persia, but lest he should be recognized there also by his name, he changed it and called himself Buddhas, B-U-D-D-A-S, Buddhas, which is very interesting. So we look at the Gnostics at this point, G-N-O-S-T-I-C, the Gnostics, idea of liberating the soul from entrapment in matter is not that dissimilar to the teachings embodied in the Four Noble Truths of the Buddha. In Buddhism, mankind is seen as trapped in suffering, or dukkha, by desire, which we know is called tanha. Its cessation is to be released by an eightfold path of right thought, right deed, right attitude, etc. But rather than salvation, an equally whimsical, you could say, nirvana is postulated. So the path of self-liberation by meditation and asceticism is demanding and sort of fails to deliver the immediate consolation ordinary people hope for. An easier option of outer mystery soon developed within both Gnosticism and Buddhism, by which devotion to the God, prayer, chanting, ringing of bells, waving incense sticks about, etc., bestow liberation, salvation, or nirvana to the God's devotees. So several exoteric forms of Buddhism developed with those outer trappings, which some people call nirvana light within some of the Buddhist areas. So from Gnosticism emerged a school called the Literalists of Christianity, for whom the Savior was giving a real historical presence. From Buddhism, Mahayana, the greater vehicle, emerged, Mahayana Buddhism, in which the real historical Buddha was gradually raised to the status of a divine incarnation. The divine Buddha, basically, one in a series of enlightened beings, and in the Lotus Sutra, faith more than enlightenment is emphasized. It emphasizes more faith in the Buddha as sufficient for salvation, and advises Buddhist missionaries to convert humanity where necessary through symbolic language and codes and parables, etc. And interestingly, the rise of Christianity and the rise of Mahayana both occurred right around the first century. The rise of Christianity and the rise of Mahayana Buddhism both occurred at the same time, and they both had the same idea, the salvation of the human race through faith. So what we look at when we compare Christianity and Buddhism, there's some interesting ideas. There is a there was a series of Buddhist plays or dramas that arose right around the first century. For instance, there's a Sanskrit play called Little Clay Cart, or it's hard to pronounce Sanskrit, but Murchaka Kakita. After a meal, an innocent man, Charadatta, is accused of murdering the courtesan Vasantasena and is brought to trial. The judge, admitting his incompetence to condemn a Brahmin, sends the case over to the king, who condemns the man to be executed and impaled with an inscription on him. Charadatta is then ordered to carry his cross to the place of execution. Meantime, the king's brother-in-law, who actually murdered the courtesan, buries her body under a pile of leaves, but she is found by a Buddhist monk who raises her from her deadly swoon. Vasantasena then saves Charadutta from death. Charadutta forgives his accuser, Samathanaka, and appoints the Buddhist monk as the head of all the Buddhist monasteries in the realm. There is a marriage in the end as well. Charadatta accepts Vatasena as a second wife. Then there's another play. In this story of Gautama, a holy man, our hero is wrongfully condemned to die on the cross for murdering the courtesan Bhadra. Gautama is impaled on a cross, and his mentor, Krishna Dvadapayana, visits him and enters into a long dialogue, at the end of which Gautama dies at the place of the skulls after engendering two offspring, the progenitors of the Ishvanaku dynasty. This is several points in this play. The death episode begins for Gautama crossing the Ganges at Magadha, which is the place of the skulls, from whence he goes on to Kusangari for a last meal. Gautama forecasts his own death three times. Gautama arrives at Kukatha, which is similar to Golgotha, the place of the skulls. Gautama twice refuses a drink. Gautama dies between two criminals. Both promise their last disciple that today they will arise in paradise, and death occurs for both of them during darkness. So these stories are very, very similar. And the dead Gautama is burned, and it is the smoke of his corpse which rises as a resurrection. This is from a 2nd to 1st century B.C. play. Samgabedavastu. So we look at the Essenes, who were a monastic order that had much in common with the contemporary Buddhists. They lived an austere existence in the desert, where they eschewed animal sacrifice of the Jerusalem temple priesthood. They were vegetarians, which was very unusual at the time. They renounced all normal enjoyments. They lived without personal property, money, or women. They recruited their numbers from newcomers. The Essenes extolled the merits of asceticism, penance, and mortification of the flesh. They were, however, unlike Buddhist monks, interested in the magical arts and the occult sciences. They believed in the pre-existence of the soul, the transmigration of the soul, and in angels as divine intermediaries or messengers from God. Now, the Essenes were in Jerusalem. They were throughout the Middle East. The striking parallels exist between early Buddhist texts and what Bible scholars postulate as the Q material. This is shorthand for Quell, the German source. The Quell materials are the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it seems highly probable that the core of the Quell material was made up of aphorisms, sayings, etc., that were that eventually became the Gospels of Matthew and Luke. And so some comparisons of these have been made by many people. From the Dhammapada, Buddha's observation, the faults of others are more easily seen than one's own, but seeing one's own failings is difficult, which is compared to the Gospel of Thomas. You see the mote which is in your brother's eye, but you do not see the beam which is in your own eye. And when it became Matthew 7, verse 3, and why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is thine own eye? And in the Buddhist work, the Dhammapada, when a mendicant, though still young, yokes himself to the Buddha's teachings, the world is illuminated like the moon freed of clouds. And Jesus' statement, he who wishes to follow me must know himself and bear my yoke. And there is a whole bunch of these. The whole idea that man should care about his brother, that he should accept responsibility for society as a whole, for needy human beings in particular, clearly precedes Christianity in Greek thought and in Buddhism. And the Buddhist philosophy of compassion and his vision of Dharma, the eternal law that sustains the cosmos, manifests itself among humanity as the moral law. The Buddha's most celebrated dictum is, hostility is never conquered by hostility in this world. Hostility is conquered by love. That is the eternal law. We find quite a bit of these comparisons. There is a whole list of this. There is the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount, which is the epitome, really, of moral law. Can be found to be very similar to many sayings of the Buddha. There was a sutta that is almost word for word the Sermon on the Mount. I can give you some examples. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. There is the fire sermon, not to serve the foolish, but to serve the spiritual, to honor those worthy of honor. This is a great blessing. Blessed are the meek, for they shall possess the land. The Buddha, from the Buddha, to dwell in the station befitting your condition, to consider the effect of your deeds, to guide the behavior aright. This is a great blessing. Blessed are they who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Much insight and education, self-control and pleasant speech, and whatever word be well spoken, this is a great blessing. Blessed are they that hunger and thirst after justice, for they shall have their fill. To support father and mother, to cherish spouse and child, to follow a peaceful calling, this is a great blessing. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. To bestow alms and live righteously, to give help to kindred, deeds which cannot be blamed, this is a great blessing. Blessed are the clean of heart, for they shall see truth. To abhor and cease from error, abstinence from strong drink, not to be weary in well-doing, this is a great blessing. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of the Most High. Reverence and lowliness, contentment and gratitude, the hearing of the law in due season, this is a great blessing. Blessed are those that suffer persecution for the sake of justice, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. To be long-suffering and meek, to associate with the tranquil, religious talk in due season, this is a great blessing. Self-restraint and purity, the knowledge of the noble truths, the attainment of nirvana, this is a great blessing. In the midst of the eight world miseries, like the person of pure life, be calm and concerned, this is a great blessing. Listener, if you keep this Dharma, the law of the spiritual world, you will know indescribable joy. This is the greatest blessing. We see that there is a great deal of similarity between these teachings. And, of course, the Buddha never claimed to be divine. He never claimed to have divine revelation. He said he discovered the path that is laid hidden, that other teachers have discovered this before him, and other teachers have discovered it after him. He never claimed to be divine and never claimed to have divine revelation. So we look at other similarities. The Buddha, consider yourself as yourself. Consider others as yourself. And Jesus said, treat others the same way you want them to treat you. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. The Buddha said, if you do not tend to one another, then who is there to tend to you? Whoever would tend me, he should tend the sick. Christ said, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did not do it to the one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. The Buddha said, just as a mother would protect her only child at the risk of her own life, even so, cultivate a boundless heart toward all beings. Yet let your thoughts of boundless love pervade the whole world. And Jesus said, this is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. No one has greater love than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. The Buddha said, hard is it to understand. By giving away our food, we get more strength. By bestowing clothing on others, we gain more beauty. By founding abodes of purity and truth, we acquire great treasures. The charitable man has found the path of liberation. He is like the man who plants a sapling, securing thereby the shade, the flowers and the fruit in future years. Even so is the result of charity. Even so is the joy of him who helps those that are in need of assistance. Even so is the great nirvana. And Jesus said, remember this, whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and whoever sows generously will also reap generously. Each man should give what he has decided in his heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver, and God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that in all things at all times, having all that you need, you will abound in every good work. You will be made rich in every way, so that you can be generous on every occasion, and through us your generosity will result in thanksgiving to God. Buddha said, the charitable man has found the path of liberation. Jesus said, in everything I showed you, that by working hard in this manner, you must help the weak and remember the words of the Lord Jesus, that he himself said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. The Buddha said, the fault of others is easily perceived, but that of oneself is difficult to perceive. A man winnows his neighbor's faults like chaff, but his own faults he hides, as a cheat hides the bad die from the gambler. Jesus said, "Judge not, that you be not judged. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, 'Let me remove a speck from your eye,' and look a plank in your own eye? Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye." The Buddha: "Hatred does not ever cease in this world by hating, but by love. This is an eternal truth. Overcome anger by love. Overcome evil by good. Become the miser by giving. Overcome the liar by truth." And Jesus: "Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you." The Buddha: "The world gives according to their faith or according to their pleasure. If a man frets about the food and the drink given to others, he will find no rest, either by night or by day." And Jesus: "Be careful not to do your acts of righteousness before men, to be seen by them. If you do, you will have no reward from your Father in heaven. So when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets, to be honored by men. I tell you the truth, they have received their reward in full. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. Then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you." Buddha: Lose self to gain nirvana and escape from suffering. Jesus: Lose self to gain Christ and entrance into heaven, where there will be no suffering. Now, these two men could have been brothers, and probably were. So, what do we make of this? What do we make of this? There are two theories. One, which is the cynical theory, is that Jesus was a literary creation by a number of people who compiled different texts and from various philosophies and put it together. I find this a specious type of reasoning, because I think it's pretty of Nazareth who taught. There was for a while a speculation that Jesus traveled to Tibet and studied under yogis and stuff, and that is pretty silly. There's a book written on that topic that Aisha went to Tibet, and that that was pretty ridiculous. The thing is, don't argue with people who've read that book and believe it. I used to do that back in the 80s and 90s when I went to psychic fairs. You know, they said, "Well, you know, Jesus went to Tibet. Jesus didn't have to go to Tibet to be exposed to Buddhist doctrine. The Buddhists were in Jerusalem." And it mentions in the Bible how Jesus, as a young man, would go to town and discuss with the philosophers that met there, and that was a major trade route. People came from everywhere. That's why the money lenders were there. The money changers were there, because people came from all over the world to do trade, to market, to sell and buy and sell things. People were there from all over the world, including India, including the Middle East, and everywhere. Buddhists were already there, and there were Buddhist colonies there. The Essenes were there, and the Buddhist Ashoka's Buddhist monks and their descendants were there. So Jesus had ample opportunity to be exposed to Buddhist texts and thoughts, and he was a scholar. So yes, you know, he didn't have to go to Tibet to be exposed to Buddhist thought. It was the Buddhists came to him. So it's a specious theory to think that he had to go on a mission to Tibet to learn at the feet of a guru. The gurus were there. The yogis were there. The Buddhist monks were already there. Every philosophy that existed in the Middle East was already there in Judea. So the similarities in these texts, it did not have to be a literary construction. It did not have to be a piece of chicanery. I believe that there was a teacher who could have been divinely inspired, who could have been a merge of God and man. But I also believe that there's ample evidence that he also was a scholar and was knowledgeable of many different philosophies, including skepticism, and including a lot of influential Buddhist texts. I think the historical record, at least the literary record, of the New Testament certainly incorporates almost word for word Buddhist texts that were in existence before the Christian era. So the question that people, the reason I bring this up even, is because people ask me, well, I'm a Christian. I don't want to, deny my Christianity to practice Buddhism. And the answer is, well, you don't have to. And, you know, there are people who say, well, John, you're a Buddhist. That must mean you're an atheist. Well, no, I'm not an atheist, nor am I an agnostic. And about that word agnostic, I'm going to throw down on that. I don't believe there's such a thing as an agnostic. That's a wishy-washy term. You either believe or you don't believe. You can't be somewhere in the vague, amorphous area. You say, well, what's an agnostic? Well, I don't know. I haven't made up my mind. Well, then you don't believe. You either believe or you don't believe. What do you mean you haven't made up your mind? Well, I don't know. Well, then you don't believe. Because belief is not a matter of knowledge, God damn it. because, you know, the thing about science or nature or fact, you don't believe in a fact, you know a fact exists. If you drop a hammer on your foot, the hammer is going to drop on your foot and hit your foot, and it's going to hurt. That's not a matter of belief, that's a fact. You can't have opinions about facts. That's the thing. A fact is a fact. You can't have an opinion about it. If you drop a hammer on your foot, it's going to fall and hit your foot. That's a fact. You can't have an opinion about it. You can't say, well, I don't know if the hammer is going to drop and hit my foot or not. The hammer is going to fall and hit your foot. That's a fact. So you don't have opinions about a fact. A belief is a belief. That means the reason it's a belief is because you can't back it up with fact. You can't test it. It's not falsifiable. Science creates hypotheses, tests it, and falsifies it. It's not a matter of belief. That's the way it works. Faith is a matter of belief. You either believe or you don't. So agnosticism, that agnostic thing, that's just, that's foxhole. That's foxhole thinking. I don't believe that there's such a thing as an agnostic. And, you know, you may disagree with me. I don't care. You either believe or you don't believe. That means you're a believer or you're not a believer. So on the question of God, you're either a believer or you're an atheist. You either believe in God or you don't. Now, I'm not an atheist. I believe that there is a consciousness, that there is a universal consciousness, and you can call that universal consciousness God. You can call that universal consciousness divine mind or whatever. But it's disingenuous to me to say, well, I don't know, so I'm agnostic. Well, if you don't know, none of us know. Even believers don't know. None of us know. So do you believe? Or do you not believe? Believe or not believe. But don't give me some half-ass answer like, well, I'm an agnostic. I haven't made up my mind. I don't know. But, well, if you haven't made up your mind, then you don't believe. You know, take a stand. Don't be a pussy. Take a stand. So here we stand now with, yes, you can be a Christian and be a Buddha and practice Buddhism. You know, being a Buddhist means you practice Buddhist techniques. It doesn't mean that you believe in things. Buddhists don't believe in things. Buddhism is a series of techniques and practices designed to free the mind from suffering. And Buddhists that don't believe in things, test things. So I know people who are Christian Zen. They do meditations and prayer. I know people who are Jewish Buddhists. They practice meditation, and they're Jewish. I have a friend who's a rabbi, and he teaches meditation. He calls himself a Buju. When I was a moderator on East Sangha, we had a whole group of Mormons who practiced Buddhist meditation. They called themselves Oxymormons, which I found endearing. So, yes, you can be a Christian, you can be Jewish, you can be a number of things, and still practice Buddhist techniques. In fact, when Buddhism went to different cultures in the world, they modified to fit in with the culture. That's why Tibetan Buddhism, Buddhism came across from India into Tibet and merged with bone shamanism, and that's why Tibetan Buddhism is very unique. It's very unique. When Buddhism went to China, it merged with Taoism and became Chan. Southern Chinese Buddhism became Chan. When Chan went to China, went to Japan, it became Zen. And if you put Zen Buddhism next to Theravada Buddhism, it doesn't look a lot alike on the surface, but at the core of all of these are the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Noble and the Eightfold Noble Path. At the core of all of those are the same. And I feel this is a very important thing, because I've had a number of people say, well, you know, I looked at Buddhism, you guys believe in God, many gods and angels and demons and deities and all these things. And no, we really don't. You know, those are described in various literatures, but we don't believe in them. We don't believe in them. Now, in meditation, you'll experience all sorts of things, depending on where you are, but you don't believe in anything. I'll tell you a story. I have a friend. You know, he's down to earth and rational, and he said, "Well, I heard somewhere about monks that levitate." And I said, "Yes. One of the side effects of deep meditative absorption are these things called siddhis, or supernormal feats." And Buddha cautioned that sometimes these will happen, and some of these are levitating, or reading minds, or leaving the body. And he said, be very careful of these, that you don't get enchanted with them, because they're distractions to liberation. And he said, so you believe that people can levitate? And I said, well, I don't believe it. And I said, but I'll tell you that there are people. I said, it's not discussed. I said, the only time you discuss a siddhi are with other people who have experienced the same siddhis that you have experienced. So you don't go around saying, yes, I've levitated, except to people who also have levitated, or I've left my body, except with other people who've left the body, because it can be misunderstood. And there is a sutta where Buddha explains why. A king has said, well, you know, your monks that can levitate and leave their body, why don't they go around and demonstrate this? And the Buddha said the same thing that people would say today. He said, well, if my monks went around and did this, there are people that would say, well, you know, the monk Mahakasapa can levitate. Isn't that a marvelous thing? He said, there will be people who will say, well, yeah, but, you know, that can be done with a trick, or by this magic charm, or by deception, or by illusion, or by hypnosis. And he said, and furthermore, there would be people who would just want to join my Sangha just to learn to levitate, and they would learn to levitate and leave. They'd have no interest in liberation. And these are all good reasons. And my friend looked at me and goes, wow, you say you guys aren't belief-based? You believe these guys can go around levitating and read minds? I said, I don't believe it. I said, I don't have to believe it. And there are things I could not tell him, things I could not discuss with him. And he said, so if I became a Buddhist, I could learn to levitate. And I said, you shouldn't become a Buddhist to learn to levitate. And he goes, well, why don't, you know, somebody go out and levitate? You know, more people would want to become a Buddhist. And I said, no, they'd want to learn to levitate. They would not want to learn liberation from suffering. They would want, cool, I can levitate. And he said, but they would more people would become Buddhists. And I said, we don't want anyone to become a Buddhist. We don't go out and lecture and evangelize and say, hey, everybody become a Buddhist. We don't do that. We don't want anyone else to become a Buddhist for the sole purpose of joining. We don't do that. You know, if you want to become a Buddhist just to levitate, that's not what we want. We, you know, we don't put ads up, and we don't have TV ads. We don't have guys on TV. We don't have guys on soapboxes on the corner saying, hey, everybody come become a Buddhist. We don't do that. You find it or you don't. We're not evangelists. And, you know, he just shakes his head at me. He goes, wow, you guys, you know. He says, you believe monks can levitate? And I said, I don't believe it. I don't have to believe it. And he just couldn't get his mind right. He kept trying to get me to say, yes, I've seen a monk levitate, which I will not and I cannot do. So, you know, leave it at that. You know, leave it at that. And I will, you know, these are things that are not discussed outside of the circles. And there are, you know, there are YouTube videos of certain things you can look at, and you can believe it or not believe it. You know, it's up to you. Personally, I don't know why it would be on YouTube, but the greatest miracle of all, the greatest siddhi of all, is liberation from suffering. And that's what Buddha said. There's a story where some disciple, some monk, came to one of the Buddhist masters. It wasn't the Buddha himself, as the story is often told, but to a Buddhist master. And they go, Master, did you see the great yogi so-and-so? He wanted to cross the stream, and the ferryman wanted 2 cents. And the yogi master said, forget that. I'm the great yogi master so-and-so. And he lifted up his robes, and he walked across the stream. And the the Buddhist master said, well, you know, that miracle's worth the 2 cents he could have paid to ride the ferry. And so, you know, things like this are 2 cent miracles. They're not that impressive. They're just not that impressive. You know, there's, so what? The great miracle is liberation from suffering. Can you attain liberation? Can you attain nirvana? That is the miracle. Not levitation, not going out of body, not reading minds, things like that. Those are parlor tricks, but they do happen as a result of a meditative absorption. And they can be used to impress the easily impressed. But it's a 2 cent miracle. You know, it's worth the 2 cents you can pay to ride the ferry across the stream. We're going to stop now for station identification, and then we'll be back with more.
You are listening to the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ali. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. The longest-running conjure show in the universe, it may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time, Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner, starring Candelo Cambisa. This is the meeting place for all esoteric traditions. Candelo brings his insight as a Polero and eclectic spiritualist to his interviews with peers in Afro-Caribbean lineages, as well as representatives of numerous other spiritualities and religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. Tuesdays feature two wonderful shows to suit your taste. On the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance and tips on the practical use of crystals and crystal balls. His show starts at 5 p.m. Pacific Time and lasts for 1 hour. Next is In the Streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly provides up-to-the-minute reports on civil and social rights issues. Her one-hour show airs on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. On Wednesday nights, Kai Armand broadcasts On Sacred Ground, a tapestry of our times comprising history, ethnography, and shamanism, featuring the voices of the land and the deceased, aided by scholars, spirit workers, and environmentalists. Kai's show airs from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. On Thursdays, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the professor shares his knowledge of roots, delivers the lucky numbers, and explores the secrets of scriptural sorcery. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. And on Saturday nights, come out and join Liquid Libations. Andrea Weston hosts this informal sharing and showcasing of poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances contributed by novices and professional wordsmiths. Call in and read your work. Liquid Libations may be heard on Saturday nights from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern, tax and license may apply, train departure times and Burma shape signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
Well, I'm back. I never really left, but I'm back. We look at the Eightfold Noble Path, and we know that the first step on it is right view, and right view is understanding the Four Noble Truths. And we've looked at the Four Noble Truths, and we know that the first noble truth is the truth of suffering. And this is the noble truth of suffering, as we only have about 5 minutes, so we'll just start on it. This is the noble truth of suffering. Birth is suffering. Aging is suffering. Sickness is suffering. Death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. Association with the unpleasant is suffering. Separation from the pleasant is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. And we discussed the aggregates before. So that last statement makes a claim that calls for some investigation, doesn't it? The five aggregates of clinging are a classificatory scheme for understanding the nature of our being. It's not a biological analysis of what makes a human being. That's very important, because people argue that, well, science says, I don't care what science says, this is a scheme for understanding the nature of our experience. What we are, the Buddha teaches, is a set of five aggregates, which is material form, the body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness, all connected with clinging. Every one of those is connected with clinging. We are the five, and the five are us. These five work together to create a sense of self. Self is a functional creation of the five aggregates of clinging. Whatever we identify with and whatever we hold to as our self always falls within the set of five aggregates. That's very important to understand. So together, these five aggregates generate the whole array of thoughts, emotions, ideas, and dispositions in which we dwell. Our world, the all, capital A. Thus, the Buddha's declaration that these five aggregates are dukkha, which is suffering, in effect, brings all experience, our entire existence, into the range of dukkha. And I'm going to tell you that dukkha, karma, and the aggregate of volition are synonymous. They're all terms of the same thing. And if you can get your mind around that, you are one step away from entering enlightenment. You're one step away from being a stream enterer. But the question comes up, why should the Buddha say that the five aggregates are dukkha? Why should he say that? Well, the reason is the five aggregates are dukkha is that they are all impermanent. They change from moment to moment. They arise and they fall away without anything substantial behind any of them persisting through the change. Nothing is substantial behind any of them. So since the very constituent factors of our being are always changing, they're all devoid of a permanent core. There's nothing that we can cling to in terms of a basis for security. There's only a constantly disintegrating flux, which when clung to in the desperate desire for permanence, leads to a plunge into a black hole of suffering. And that is the first noble truth of suffering. So the second noble truth points out that the cause of this dukkha is craving, or tanha, thirst, is the dominant and most pervasive cause of the origin of suffering. And the noble truth of the origin of suffering is this craving produces repeated existence, and it's bound up with delight and lust. It seeks pleasure here and there, namely, and specifically, craving for sense pleasures, craving for existence, and craving for non-existence, those three. Third noble truth reverses this relationship. If craving is the cause of dukkha, then to be free of the dukkha, we have to eliminate craving. And so the right view of noble truth then leads to the fourth noble truth that shows the way to reach the end of dukkha, the way to the realization of nirvana, is the noble eightfold path itself. So the right view of the noble truths develop in two stages. The first is called the right view that accords with the truth. The second is the right view that penetrates the truths. It's mundane right view and super mundane right view. So to acquire the right view requires a clear understanding of their meaning and significance in our lives. So first you learn the truths and you study them. And secondly, you reflect on the truth and meditate upon them until you gain a strong conviction as to their truth and their veracity. And that's very important. That's what right view is. You gain a strong understanding that these are true. They're noble truths, which means they penetrate everything, every aspect of existence. That's right view. So at the climax of this contemplation, the mental eye turns away from conditioned phenomena to the goal, which is nirvana. And next week, we'll look more into right view, and we'll go from there to the second step, which, of course, is right intention. And sometimes that's called right thought. And I'll see you next week. Love you all. Bye-bye.